want to do something this morning that I don't normally do. I normally don't read my message, but I plan to read it this morning. I've written it. I want to read it because I want you to hear it as a story. It's a story. It's a story that's taken from the Bible. Sometimes when we think about God using people in the Bible, we think that they're almost saints, perfect people like Mother Teresa or some family without problems, no one with issues. But I want you to listen to the story. I want you to listen to the story and see if these families that are part of this story and the places they lived and the things that happened to them, see if you might can identify with some of these families. That they maybe they were less than perfect. Maybe they had issues. And yet still, God, in a wonderful way, wove their lives and their experiences into his purpose and plans, just like he can do that for us. So listen very carefully to the story. I'm going to start from the beginning. We get to the story of basically a particular people and God's promises to them, and it's actually the history of a family. It follows this family in various times and the settings they lived in from one generation to the next over a long period of time. So I'm going to start with the first family, the family there in Genesis. You know, that family had it good for a while. They lived in paradise. They walked with God in fellowship. But they messed up big time. They messed up so bad they got themselves evicted out of paradise. That's pretty bad. Bad start. But after this, they had children. So things seemed to look better. They had two sons. They had other children, but their two famous sons we know as Cain and Abel. But some problems developed. As they were trying to teach their sons to worship God, well, their sons would bring offerings, and it so happens that God had favor with the younger son's offering more than he did his older brother's, and that made bad things happen. The older brother got bitter towards his younger brother, ended up murdering his younger brother. So this first family got evicted out of paradise and had and an older son that murdered his younger brother. Well, they did have another son later on. His name was Seth. The word Seth means to set in place. And according to the Bible, the story is that at that time, men began to call upon the name of the Lord and to worship him. Well, what the older son had to do is he had to be driven away from the family. So not only were they evicted from paradise, the older son murdered the younger, but now the older son is completely driven away from the family, and he begins to roam the earth, and his descendants individually begin to build cities, forge metals, and make a lot of progress in the arts and with music. They were some of the leaders in technology of the world at their time. Whereas Seth, the one who means to set in place when men begin to worship the Lord, they weren't like that. They didn't tend to be drawn to cities. They were more like nomads. They tried not to intermingle with their cousins because their cousins were some pretty bad people. Unfortunately, Cain's family was too much like their dad. And they were just wicked people. And the situation on the earth got worse and worse and worse. And so the descendants of Seth, his family, they tried not to mingle with their cousins too much. Some of y'all know what I'm talking about. You're kind of in those situations now. But unfortunately, they attractions happen, and the family lines crossed and mingled, and that just created further problems. And the situation on the earth began to be so bad that it says that men's thoughts, even from their youth, were just evil continually. And the earth became full of violence. So much that it grieved the Lord, it even made mankind. And he decided to intervene to keep it from getting worse, while he could, he set out a plan that he was going to destroy mankind before the entire world was ruined by their wickedness. Fortunately, some of Seth's family had kept the faith. One of them was a man named Enoch, a man who walked with God for 300 years. Enoch would preach about the judgment that God was going to send upon everyone who was living a wicked life. You can actually read some of what he preached about in the New Testament, in the book of Jude. Enoch had a great-grandson named Noah. Noah learned about his great-grandfather. And it impacted Noah's life very much. Noah thought about what his great-grandfather would preach, and Noah chose to live the way his great-grandfather did. He was a righteous man. He not like the other people in the world at that time, and God saw it. And this allowed Noah to find favor with God. And so God revealed to Noah what he had planned to do to destroy the earth, and God gave Noah a plan to be able to save himself and his family, his wife, and his three sons. He had three sons, and they were married. Noah preached about what was going to happen, but everyone thought he was a fool. No one listened to him. But God was patient during this time. God waited 100 years to send the flood that he had planned to destroy everything that had breath on the earth, all men and all animals. He gave Noah the plan about building the ark that would save himself and his family, but no one else listened but his wife, his three sons, and their wives. And God was patient while it took Noah 100 years to build this ark. But then it happened. God sent the flood exactly like he said. Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their wives were the only ones that were saved. The only ones that survived were the ones that were with Noah in the ark, and the Lord had caused two of every kind of animal to join Noah in the ark so that animal life on the earth would be preserved. After the flood, the story continues primarily through the line of Shem, the oldest son of Noah. Shem was the ancestor of a man most of us have heard about, the man Abram. And actually, Shem lived long enough that Abraham might have actually met, or Abram at this time, Abram might have actually met Shem and heard all about the flood. And it affected him. Men began to spread out on the earth after the flood, and Abraham and his descendants found themselves living in one of the most advanced civilizations at that time. He lived in the Mesopotamian region between the Euphrates and what is the other river? Euphrates? Tigris. Huh? The Tigris and Euphrates River, that's right. And he was living in the city of Ur when God revealed himself to Abram and said, "All right, Abram, I want you out of this place. Leave your country. Leave your relatives. Leave your father's house and come to the place where I will show you." Now, Abraham was 75 years old. He's practically a senior citizen. He'd been married a number of years because it says his wife was barren. She couldn't have any children. So here Abraham, almost a senior citizen, takes his barren wife and what in his possessions and heads out to where he doesn't even know where he's going. But he obeys and he goes. And God led Abraham to the land of Canaan. But he really didn't have any permanent place. Abram lived as a nomad. He just traveled around looking for places that were sufficient to keep his livestock well fed. And at this time, after about 10 years of living in Canaan as a nomad, God appeared to Abraham again and said that he was going to make him, get this, the father of many nations. That he was going to bless him so that he would be a blessing. He says, "I'm going to bless all of mankind through you. Your descendants are going to become so numerous, you can't even count them. They're going to be like the stars in the heaven. You're not going to be able to count them." Well, wait, Abraham had been married a long time without kids. His wife was barren. But Abraham did something quite amazing. He believed what God said, even though he was so old. And it, the Bible says that God considered that righteousness to him, counted it righteousness to him. It didn't happen right away, though. Abraham had to wait nearly another 25 years to see this promise come about. About 24 years later, God appeared to Abraham on the way to deal with Sodom and Gomorrah. That's when God told Abraham, I want you to circumcise yourself, your other, that other boy that happened with Abraham took the maid of Sarah, Ishmael, and we don't talk about that story. That's kind of one of those family closet things that you kind of keep in the closet. But they did things like that back then. But no, God said, it's going to be you and Sarah. Sarai, your wife, is going to have a son. You're going to call him Isaac, which means laughter. And so Abraham did this. Abraham obeyed. He circumcised himself and Ishmael and all the servant, male servants in his household. And 1 year later, to the date, Sarai had a baby boy. She was almost 90 years old. Abraham was nearly 100. Yes. Isn't that incredible? Yes. Abraham evidently had more children, the Bible said, according to the story. But God made it clear to him that Isaac was going to be the one that is going to carry on the blessing. So the story continues with Isaac, who married Rebekah, and who, after failing to conceive for many years, finally became pregnant. The thing is, her pregnancy was kind of difficult because evidently the babies fought all the time inside the womb. So much so that she kind of wondered about it and asked God about it, prayed about it, and was told there's two boys in your womb. There are going to be two nations, and they're going to wrestle, and the older one is going to end up serving the younger. And so sure enough, when the time for her birth came, she gave birth to twin boys. But they weren't identical twins, not in the least. These guys were as different as night and day. One came out all hairy and red, and one came out all fair skin. Esau, the one hairy red, he was born first. He's the older brother. He was dad's favorite because he was a man's man, a hunter. He would go out and kill game and bring back, and his dad loved him because this guy was a man's man. Jacob was a mama's boy. He liked to hang around the tent with mama and cling to mama's skirts. And so, you know, already you got issues with that. When you got favorites in a household, you got issues, okay? So you know how that is. Well, Jacob was an opportunist. You might even say a conniver. And a pretty smart conniver, too. One time, his older brother Esau was coming back from hunting and was starving. He hadn't been able to kill anything. So evidently he may have been hunting a couple of days. He was starving, and Jacob was cooking some bowls, like a bowl of beans, some lentils. And Esau asked for something to eat, and Jacob saw an opportunity. Okay, sell me your birthright, and I'll give you something to eat. And Esau didn't care much about his birthright. He said, what good is it to me anyway if I die? Of course, all right, it's a deal. So Jacob got his brother's birthright just by being an opportunist. But he didn't stop there. Later on, he heard that his dad Isaac was getting ready to give Esau the blessing that was so important as the firstborn. And Rebekah, his mom, heard about it. And the two of them connived together to cheat the brother out of the birthright. I mean, it took some work because, remember, Esau was all red and hairy and Jacob's his fair skin. So they had this idea, dress him up in his brother's clothes, and they got some goat skin and covered the parts of his arms because his dad was so old he couldn't see. Anyway, the scheme worked. He ended up cheating, deceiving his father into getting the blessing of his brother. But man, as soon as his father and brother found out, it was terrible. It was so bad, his older brother vowed to kill him now. I mean, that's it. He got me, he took basically cheated me out of my birthright, and now he's cheated and stolen the blessing. I'm going to kill him. So just to keep himself alive, he had to leave. His mom sent him off to live with some relatives, and he came to live with his uncle Laban. How many of you ever lived with an uncle? it says Jacob the conniver ended up working for Laban for 7 years, and Laban, a kind-hearted man, you shouldn't work for anything. tell me what you'd like. Well, Jacob had fallen in love with Laban's daughter, Rachel, because she was gorgeous. She was a knockout. And so Laban said, look, I'll let you marry. But you don't have anything. You know, Jacob had to leave home with nothing. So you have nothing to give me. I say, what? Work for me for 7 years. At the end of 7 years, I'll give you my daughter, Rachel. Jacob agreed to the deal. He loved Rachel. The story says it seemed like such a short time because he loved her so much that at the end of 7 years, the wedding day came. And, you know, back then, they don't have lights like this. The wedding lasted into the evening, and there's camp light, and there's torches, and the bride is there all veiled. And the party is, they're having a good time. They probably party way into the evening, and they probably had a little too much to party with. So anyway, after the party was over, and the couple retired and went to bed the next morning, Jacob wakes up, and there's Leah, the older sister, in bed with him. It's not even Rachel. And he is shocked, and he is furious, and he goes back to his uncle, demanding, what in the world have you done? I agreed to work for Rachel. And Laban just said, well, it's against our custom to give away the younger sister before we give away the older one. Sorry. So the conniver had been had. The con man had been conned. What could he say? He's tasted some of his own medicine. But Laban's smart. Laban's pretty sharp himself. I'll tell you what. We can fix this. Look, enjoy the older sister for a week. At the end of a week, I'll let you have her sister Rachel too as your wife, as long as you work for me another 7 years. What choice did Jacob have? He had to agree to it. And so at the end of the week, Rachel became his second wife. Now he's got two wives, but he has to work another 7 years for it. You know, some of us have a difficult enough time with one wife. But Jacob had two. And I'm not saying it's the wife's fault, but it's probably because we are so bad at being husbands that we make it hard for them. So don't, ladies, it's not a slight on you. But anyway, having two wives did not make it very easy for him. And, you know, Rachel was the beautiful one. The Bible describes Leah, the older sister, as the one with weak eyes. But the issue is, Leah was fertile Myrtle. I mean, right, she started having kids right away. I mean, boom, 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 boy, boy, boy. I mean, four in a row she had. And it drove Rachel crazy because Rachel couldn't get pregnant to give her for anything. So Rachel had an idea. This is the idea. She would take her maid, her own personal maid, and give it as a wife to Jacob so that she could be a mom through her maids. And actually it worked. So now Jacob's got two natural wives and a concubine wife. So he's three. Well, fertile Myrtle stopped having kids, the older sister Leah. But she saw what her sister did. Well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right? So she decided, I'm going to take my personal maid, and I'm going to give him, and she'll have, so I can have more children through her. So Leah gave her maidservant to Jacob. So now he's got two natural wives and two concubine wives. And after a period of time, he ends up with four wives, 10 sons, and a daughter. And during this time, he finally gets to where he wants to go back home. His father's still alive. But he hasn't been able to go back home because remember what happened, why he left home in the first place? His brother wants him dead. That's what he remembered. But he got the courage to somehow decide, the Lord gave him encouragement to say, go home, I'll be with you. So, anyway, he heads back home. And on the way there, with his entourage of wives and sons, he hears that Esau is on the way to greet him with 400 armed men. So it is not looking very well. But Jacob's a conniver. So he thinks, okay, how can I do this? I tell you what I'll do. I will send a bunch of gifts ahead. I'll give him some camels, and I'll send some camels up, then I'll send some sheep, and I'll send some goats, and I'll send some donkeys, and it'll pacify. It'll pacify the brother so that he won't kill me. And then he separates his wives and his kids by the concubine wives and their sons first, and then his natural wives. And, of course, Rachel's the last one. And he thinks, well, if he attacks one, it'll give the others time to escape. And then he himself decides that he's not even going to stay with any of them. He's going to cross the river, sit and spend the night on the other side by himself. And he does. And that's where the story says that he had this encounter. The angel of the Lord appeared to him, and he wrestled with the angel of the Lord all night long. And Jacob had this sense that this person could bless him. And Jacob knows how powerful a blessing is. And so it's getting near morning, and the angel of the Lord is telling Jacob, let me go. And Jacob won't let me go. He said, no, I'm not letting you go until you bless me. And he got near morning, and Jacob was so stubborn, and the angel could not get him off him. The angel finally touched Jacob in his side and paralyzed his sciatic nerve so that his side no longer worked, and received his blessing. At that time, the angel of the Lord says, your name will no longer be Jacob, because you have prevailed with men and God and have overcome. Your name shall be Yisrael. Yisra's prince, and El is short for Elohim. Your name will be the prince of Elohim. And so Jacob became Israel, but he did so limping the rest of his life. So he does end up making it back home with his 10 sons and his wife. But on the way home, Rachel is pregnant. On the road to Bethlehem, it says, Rachel goes into labor, and it's very, very difficult. So difficult, the complications develop. She gives birth to a son, but she ruptures and she dies from childbirth. As she's dying, she names the son Ben-Oni, son of my misery. Jacob hears that Rachel has died, but she gave birth to a son. And that they told him that she named a boy son of my misery, Ben-Oni. And Jacob says, no, that's not going to be his name. His name is going to be Ben-Yamin, son of my right hand. And so now you have Jacob and his three wives left, and his 11 sons and daughters. And this is how Jacob, who became Israel, there's 11 sons. But when you think of Israel, you think of his sons being the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, how did this happen? Well, if you remember the story, later on when the family goes to Egypt, and you remember why they ended up in Egypt? Because Jacob, this family, Jacob the conniver, he loved one son. I mean, when you have 11 sons and you love one way more than the other 10, can you anticipate problems? Well, Jacob loved Joseph and showed him favor, even gave him special clothes that kind of show off how much he was favored by his father. And all it made his brothers do was hate him. They hated him. But God used their hate to cause them to sell their brother into slavery. They were going to kill him, but the older brother was tried to kind of keep him from killing their brother. They said, let's don't kill him. Let's make some money from him. And they sold him to some traders who took him down to Egypt, where he ended up a slave in Egypt. You know the story. He started working for this Egyptian named Potiphar. He was so successful, everything in Potiphar's house was blessed. But Potiphar's wife had an eye and a lust for Joseph. And she kept trying to get him to sleep with her, and he refused. One time, she caught him alone in the house with no one else there. She tried to force it to happen. He ran, but she had on his coat. And she yelled, she yelled and made it look like he was the one trying to attack her. Of course, Potiphar, who he's working for, was furious, didn't believe him, had him thrown in prison unjustly, no trial. He was there years until he met two servants from Pharaoh's court, ended up interpreting their dream. The cupbearer, who was ended up being restored back to the Pharaoh's service, Joseph had told him, listen, I'm not in here for anything I've done. Would you tell Pharaoh about me and get me out of here? Well, of course, you know, the cupbearer was restored just like Joseph interpreted the dream would be. But the cupbearer forgot. And 2 years went by. But what happened to change things was Pharaoh had a dream. Remember the dream? The dream about the years of plenty and the years of famine. And that's when the cupbearer remembered, oh, Pharaoh, there's this person and I met in prison. Remember when you were mad at me? I was in prison. He interpreted my dream, and I'm back serving you just like he told. And the other guy, the baker, it happened to him. You did that. And so Pharaoh called for him right away, and Joseph ends up interpreting the dream and ends up the second in command of all Egypt. The years of plenty, there's 7 years of plenty. Joseph is put in charge, stores up 1/5 of all the grain in 7 good years. And then the famine comes. 2 years into the famine, Joseph's family runs out of food. And now Jacob and his other brothers up there in Canaan have to hear that there's grain in Egypt. And Jacob sends his sons down there. And after almost 18 years, Joseph is in his royal chambers. And these, I believe at that time, 9 other of his brothers come. Or 10, maybe 10 of his brothers come and bow down before him. And he remembers the dreams God had given him years earlier, 18 years ago. And realizes something. It happened exactly like the dream said. We end up, the story is wonderful. It's here in Egypt that Joseph is given a wife, the daughter of the priest of On. And he has 2 sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And it's these 2 sons that end up being counted as the other 2 tribes of Israel. So you, instead of Joseph being one, his 2 sons replace him. So it's the 10 brothers of Joseph and Joseph's 2 sons. And now you have 12 tribes of Israel. Amen. And it's while they were living in Egypt that the years of their father came to an end. But right before Jacob was about to die, he called all of his sons to him so that he could bless them. He knew the importance of blessing. Well, of course, and not surprising, the one son who got the blessing, the greatest blessing, was Joseph. But what is surprising is the other son that got a prophetic, miraculous blessing. And that's the son Judah. Judah was given this blessing that seemed like he was going to be in a ruler, in authority. And let me read the blessing. I actually have it here. Judah, your brother, shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. How incredible. How did Jacob know this? How did he know this to be able to pronounce this? That's just a part of the story. So although the whole family still has important roles to play, because after this, you know, the Moses comes and after 400 years of slavery and delivers them, the main part of the story is now going to continue through the tribe of Judah. And they become kind of the focus of God's promise and prophecy. And Judah has 3 sons. But not all of his sons were what we would want as sons. Er was the firstborn, then he had Onan, and then he had a younger son. But the Bible says that Er was wicked, and the Lord took his life. He had married this young lady named Tamar. So now Tamar was a widow, and according to the custom, Judah gave Tamar to the other brother, Onan, so that he could continue his brother's line. That was just one of the customs of the day. But Onan didn't have anything to do with it. Onan did everything he could to make sure that Tamar would not become pregnant. And when God saw what was going on, the Lord took his life too. So now Judah has 1 son left and a daughter-in-law that's seen two of his other sons killed while she was their wife. But he tells her, Tamar, look, you just stay with me, stay in the family. When my youngest son is old enough, I'll give you to him. But he had no intention of doing that. He had already lost two. He only had one left. And sure enough, the youngest son got old enough, but dad reneged on his promise. And Tamar realized that it wasn't going to happen. She saw the youngest son was old enough to be married, and it never came about. Judah never mentioned it again. During that time, Judah's wife died. And it said they have a traditional period of mourning. After the period of mourning was over, he decided he'd go down and see his sheep being sheared. So he had to travel. Tamar got wind of it, and an idea was born in her mind. She rushed out secretly, disguised herself, and got ahead of him on the way and posed as a temple prostitute in the city where he had to pass by. And as Judah was passing by on the way, you know, he's a man, he's weak, his wife is gone. He gave into a moment of vulnerability, and he notices this prostitute over here, and he approaches her and asks to sleep with her. And he doesn't recognize. Tamar is so well disguised, he didn't recognize her. And she bargains with him, okay, what are you going to give me? If we sleep, you know, if I fulfill it, what are you going to give me? And he goes, I'll give you a lamb from the flocks. I'm going on the way to see me. On the way back, I'll give you this lamb. She goes, well, what are you going to give me in pledge? You got to give me something, you know, so how I know you keep your word. So he gives her two of his things, his seal and his staff, and I think his staff. And so they sleep together. And off he goes, and as soon as they finish sleeping together, Tamar's gone. She's out of there with his staff and seal. And it's interesting, the Lord saw the situation, and Tamar conceived from that time. So when Judah comes back with the lamb to give to the prostitute, she's nowhere to be found. He goes, well, I guess I don't know what to do. Okay. He ends up going back home. 3 months later, Tamar starts showing, and those around her see that she's pregnant, and they report it to Judah. And Judah's told Tamar's been unfaithful. She's been messing around with somebody, and she's pregnant. So he calls her, and he's going to deal with her. And he starts to deal with her until she explains, you're the father. And he is shocked. How can you say I'm the father? Aren't these your items that you gave me in pledge? She shows him the seal and the staff. He leaves her alone. He realizes he's broken his word. He hasn't kept his promise. And she's actually more righteous than he is. She ends up with twins. One of them is named Perez. It's interesting who came from Perez. The next name that you would recognize in the story that came from Perez is named Boaz. You ever heard of a guy named Boaz?
Yes.
Yeah. Boaz, he has an interesting background. We know Boaz is a righteous man, but he's a descendant of pretty strange situations going on, isn't he? But what's even more strange is Boaz's mother was also a harlot. Boaz's mother was Rahab from Jericho. She married Boaz's dad, Salmon. So from this line, we got Judah and his own daughter-in-law hooking up, and we have an Israelite marrying a prostitute from Jericho, and out of it comes Boaz. And you know where they're from? Boaz is from the tribe of Judah. So you know where they're settling? You know where their hometown is? Bethlehem. All of this is taking place in the area of Bethlehem. There was another family there, living there in Bethlehem, that were relatives of Boaz. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. Now, Elimelech and Naomi were living in Bethlehem, but times got hard. Evidently, there was a drought, and it got so bad that Elimelech decided to take Naomi and their two sons and go to the land of Moab. Moabs are distant cousins, that part of the family that you don't want to talk about too often. But when times get hard, you'll go to family members that you wouldn't even eat with, you know, if it gets that bad. So Elimelech took Naomi and his two sons and moved to Moab, and his sons were older, so they had to get wives for them. So I ended up picking two Moabite women. The Israelites were not even supposed to have anything to do with the Moabites. You know that the law of Moses says no Moabite or Ammonite shall enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. You're not to intermarry with them, don't have anything to do with them. I know they're related, but that's that part of the family you don't want to have anything to do with. Well, their two sons married two Moabite women. And then you know what happened? Elimelech dies. The dad dies. And then both sons die. And that leaves Naomi from Bethlehem with two daughter-in-laws who are widows. They don't have Social Security back then. Who's going to provide for them? Naomi has no way to provide for them. She tries to convince them, go back home, go to your family. What do I have? One of the daughter-in-laws goes home. The other one says, no way. Nothing's going to separate from me from you. She says, wherever you go, that's where I'm going. Your people are going to be my people. Your God are going to be my God. You know who this person was? What's her name? Ruth the Moabite. Ruth the Moabite. Well, Naomi hears that the situation in Bethlehem has improved, that they've had rain and they're harvesting again. So she and Ruth decide to go back home. And when they show up in Bethlehem, it creates quite the stir. See, Naomi's name means pleasant one. But she shows up having left Bethlehem with a husband and two sons, and she shows back up, no husband, no sons, and a Moabite daughter-in-law. And the people are just shocked. And here's what she tells the people. Don't call me pleasant one. Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. My life has been bitter. She said, the Lord has made my life bitter. Now what are these ladies going to do? They've got to eat. So fortunately, in Israel at the time, they had this provision where the poor could get some food by going to the edges of the where the people were harvesting and picking up scraps from the harvest. Some of the gleanings that were left over that would fall out of the bundles that they were bundling. And Ruth ended up finding this place and she was gleaning, and it happened to be the field of Boaz, who happened to be a relative of Naomi's husband Elimelech. And when Naomi saw Ruth coming back with this basket full of grain, she asked, where in the world were you today, child? And she said, this older guy named Boaz. And hope revived in Naomi. And she realized God was up to something. This man is a relative. And the story, as you know, goes, Boaz and Ruth married there. And they had a son there. His name was Obed. And Obed had a son there named Jesse. Jesse was Ruth's grandson. And then Jesse had a number of sons there. One of Jesse's sons was named David. Ruth's great-grandson. Isn't that incredible? Here in Bethlehem, David is born. And David is the one, you remember, Saul was the first king of Israel. David was the second and the most famous king of Israel because he was the man after God's own heart. The man that God chose, even though he was the youngest of seven brothers. Jesse in the town of Bethlehem, Samuel the prophet shows up, not explaining why he's there. He just wants to see all of Jesse's sons. Jesse parades all of his sons before him, the oldest to the youngest. Well, almost. Samuel sees the oldest and thinks, man, this guy is it. And he starts to anoint him, and the Lord says, no, don't look at the outward things. I've not chosen him. I, the Lord, look upon the heart. I've not chosen any of these. Samuel turns to Jesse and says, this is all your sons? Well, almost. The youngest one's out with the sheep. Samuel tells him, I'm not sitting down till you call him. and he comes. And that's when David was called from the shepherd's field and comes, and Samuel anoints him with oil. And the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him. And David becomes the greatest king in Israel's history.
Amen.
And all this takes place in Bethlehem. That's why it's called Bethlehem, the city of David. It's a story. It's a family. You see how much has happened in this family already? The people that God used? And yet, the story doesn't stop there. God promises David that one of his sons is always going to sit on the throne. That his dynasty would last forever. And David receives this promise. But things happen. And not all of David's sons are like David. There's a few good ones. There's some of David's descendants were good. But quite a few of them were so bad. Things just didn't go well. Hundreds of years go by. And it just doesn't look like there's no throne. The Romans are ruling the land of Palestine. There's no king in Israel except this guy named Herod. And he's not even a true Jew. He's an Edomite. He's another one of them distant cousins. And no one liked him. And he's just a puppet ruler. He can't be the fulfillment of this promise that God made to David. No way. And then something strange happens. An angel of the Lord appears to this young woman. After hundreds of years of silence, 400 years of silence, an angel of the Lord appears to this virgin, young woman, who was already betrothed. They were legally married, but they had not consummated the marriage. They didn't have the marriage ceremony. And the angel tells us, Mary, that you were going to conceive. And Mary's like, how? I've never even been with a man. And he says, well, the power of God's going to come upon you. And the child to be born in you is going to be called the Son of God. And, I mean, Mary is shocked. But it happens. She becomes pregnant. And before long, she has to kind of own up to Joseph. So what would you tell? What would you tell your fiance, Joseph? I'm pregnant, but it's not what you think. I haven't been with any man. God just made me pregnant. Well, I mean, if it were you, would you believe? Joseph didn't believe her. But he was a righteous man, so he just made plans to try to put her away. A quiet divorce that would not shame her, wouldn't expose her and make her a public spectacle. But an angel appeared to Joseph and said, no, what Mary told you was true. The child in her womb is going to be called the Son of God, and you're going to name him Jesus because he's going to save his people from their sins. And so Joseph went ahead and took Mary as his wife, even though they just kind of lived separately because they weren't quite sure, I think, what to do at this point. But they're way up in Nazareth, and there's these prophecies about a Messiah coming in the future that's going to involve, Mary knows it's somehow going to involve them, but she's pregnant. They're up in Nazareth. They're miles and miles away from Bethlehem. And whatever takes place, this Messiah, the Son of God, the Son of David, is going to be associated somehow with Bethlehem. So what happens? Well, Caesar Augustus, the emperor of Rome, decides it's time to take a census. And when you take a census, you tell everybody to go back to your hometown to register so they can verify that they've got everyone from that family is registered. Then they can tax the people and build up the money. It takes a lot of money to run an empire. So the decree went forth, and that is the only reason that Joseph would have ever taken his very pregnant wife, Mary, on that kind of journey south. You would never take someone that far along pregnant and travel for miles and miles and miles. Whether she walked or whether she rode on a donkey or whether she rode on a horse. You tell me, ladies, 9 months pregnant, how you would do riding on a horse or walking 8 hours a day for a week. Wouldn't be very pleasant. Sleeping on the ground. There's no way Joseph would have ever taken her there, but he was forced to. And so you know where they ended up? Guess where Joseph was from? Bethlehem, because he happened to be of the house of David. And evidently they traveled a lot slower than everyone else. I mean, your wife's 9 months pregnant. You're not going to make very good time. So everyone else got there ahead of them. So it's no surprise that the story says when they got there, they couldn't find any rooms. All the rooms were already taken. But and I think it's because of the trip. The trip or the trauma or just the right time, we don't know. But when about the time they hit Bethlehem, Mary went into labor big time. So Joseph doesn't have time to find a kind of room. Everywhere he's checked, they're already all booked. He's forced to do something he would never do on his own. He just finds a place out of the weather. There's a barn behind one of the inns. Yeah, we call it a stable. It's the barn where they keep the animals. And so because Mary's going to pop anytime, they get back into the barn and she has her son and wraps him in clothes for warmth. And it was a practice they did. They liked to keep the babies, their arms and limbs tied against them. I think it was a security thing too. But there's no crib, but there is a trough. There's a hay trough right there. We call it a manger, but it's a place where the animals would eat their hay. So she lays the baby right there. And that's the story. A true story. Not a single part of it made up. Real families with real issues, real problems. And God somehow managed through it all to accomplish what he said he was going to do from the very beginning. So why would I want to tell this story? Because I want to tell you, if you're somehow thinking because of what's going on in your family, God could never use you that way, you're just wrong. God uses the most unlikely people. And God uses people that have had problems. And God uses people with family matters that aren't all settled. And God is able to make something beautiful with ordinary people like you and me. Yes. And that's a true story. It is. It's not fiction. It's history. Isn't it beautiful? That's all I just wanted you to hear that this morning.